life can be hard. A couple of the things that make life sometimes difficult are as follows. Failure and success. Now, the poor gentleman in Jesus' story for today in the 12th chapter of Luke is a victim of success. He is shocked, we found out last week, to discover that his land has produced abundantly. And he ends up struggling with what he's going to do. Jesus has a very clear diagnosis for how this poor guy ends up in the state he's in. And the way the final verdict is sort of rolled out for us in this story is as follows. So in our slide now, we see the end of how this story really begins. God gives this verdict. You fool. This very night, your life is being demanded of you. In fact, the word life in the story in Greek is exactly the same as the word for soul. It's the word psyche. And it's very interesting, the wordplay being used, that earlier in the passage, we find this guy really has nobody else to talk to but his own soul. And he says to his soul, he has this conversation, and now God's verdict on his perspective is, you haven't used your soul. I want it back. Jesus, at other places in the New Testament, says, what a tragedy it is when someone gains the whole world and loses their soul. So this is the diagnosis that Jesus made. We said last week that it really involves three L's. The first is this love of control. This guy completely misunderstands the power of love for connecting us with one another and connecting us with God. His love of control and his perspective on his own universe destroys the very reason he's put here on this earth, which creates for him a lack of community and ultimately a loss of soul. What's fascinating about this story, and as we talked about it last week, this diagnosis comes with a little background. Jesus didn't just make this story up. What's fascinating and what's really important for us to see the connection of what Jesus is doing as he tells this story, he's actually creating an echo from the Old Testament. We find out that as the diagnosis unfolds, you remember last week we talked about the pronouns that were used. So let's look at the middle part of the 12th chapter of Luke and remind ourselves this is all about part of the diagnosis that this poor fellow who's a victim of his own success, he completely focuses on what? The highlighted pronouns. I, me, and mine. He's so self-absorbed. And the sad reality that Jesus is making clear in this story is he can't really see beyond himself, when in fact there's a whole reality that he needs to acknowledge that will enrich his soul, not rob him of the very reason he's here. What Jesus is doing, though, in this 12th chapter is interesting. So this is an echo of an earlier story that's almost identical, and it takes place in a book in the Old Testament called Ecclesiastes. Some of you perhaps are familiar with this very philosophical book in the Old Testament. And in Ecclesiastes, in the second chapter, there's almost the identical dilemma of somebody else. So let's see. Notice the same kind of pronouns are highlighted in this. I made great works. This is Koheleth, the teacher, who is sort of taking on a playful role play of somebody struggling with trying to find meaning. So listen to what he does. I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks and planted them in all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. I also had possessions of herds and flocks more than any who had come before me in Jerusalem. And I also gathered for myself silver and gold. Who was this guy stuck on? I, me, and mine. It's exactly the same template that Jesus uses in the 12th chapter of Luke. And what's fascinating is both in Ecclesiastes and we suspect in perhaps the Gospel of Luke, the audience that this really is to resonate with is a bunch of folks who look and sound an awful lot like you and me. People enamored with the possibility of maybe if I just work a little harder and make a little more money, I can move ahead in life and I can be abundant and rich. And then the final comparison that's interesting, where it's clear now, Jesus makes it clear that he's quoting from and pulling from Ecclesiastes. In the 12th chapter, listen to this. This guy says to his soul, "Now you have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, and be merry." And what is it that the teacher in Ecclesiastes chapter 8 says? There's nothing better for people under the earth than to eat, drink, and be merry or enjoy themselves. What's Jesus doing? He's pulling from this ancient wisdom of Ecclesiastes and dropping it into this more current day for his own disciples and the surroundings and for you and me. Because the relevance of that ancient wisdom of Ecclesiastes, the power of Jesus' words, and the dilemmas we find ourselves in today are very, very similar. Now, the final piece of this puzzle that lies in the background of what Jesus is teaching us in the 12th chapter is a conclusion that Koheleth, the teacher of Ecclesiastes, makes. The way Ecclesiastes ends is fascinating. There is, throughout Ecclesiastes, this familiar phrase, "When I searched for these things, when I accomplished all these things, when I did all these things, I discovered even then, vanity, vanity, all is vanity. It doesn't really matter." The one thing, the conclusion of Ecclesiastes the teacher offers is this. What is it all about and why are we here? The teacher says, "Fear God and obey his commandments." Now, we're going to do what I think Jesus expected, lying in the background of this 12th chapter of Luke. The diagnosis is clear. This guy's life has no meaning at all. What he lacks, we're going to review just a little bit, reminding ourselves the power and the value and the boundaries created by the commandments. Now, there are 613, so we're going to be here a while. Just plan on having lunch a little later. No, we're going to focus on the top 10, the commandments' greatest hits. Now, here they are. How many of you have remember or have learned the 10 commandments? There's one God. Do not make idols. Do not use the Lord's name in vain. Remember the Sabbath and keep it holy. Honor your father and your mother. Do not kill. Do not commit adultery. Do not steal. Do not spread rumors or gossip. Do not covet what other people have. There'll be a test following our service for you to bring back these Ten Commandments. Now, here's the thing. I used to think I did pretty well on this list. I never made idols. Have you ever noticed in the New Testament, Paul talks an awful lot about idol worship? And I used to think, those foolish people, how strange they were that Paul needed to continue to harp on this bizarre concern of idol worship. How many of you have something in your pocket that you've silenced and you can't wait to leave and turn it on and see if anybody has communicated with you on social media how your latest Facebook post is responding to the community of people that you want to impress? Or you're struggling today because all those people on social media seem to be so happy and you're miserable. Idols are anything in our lives that give us false purpose or a sense of meaning that has nothing to do with God. And we are as guilty today as those people then in worshiping idols. I have felt pretty good about number three. Don't use the Lord's name in vain. Now, in Tennessee, this was a pretty clear rule. You could cuss, but you couldn't use God's name in the cuss. You were okay. You didn't violate the third commandment. Bill mentioned in our pastor prayer this morning, the Muslim community in New Zealand and across the world has been rocked by a violence stemming from a philosophy called white supremacy. White supremacy is based on the fact that God made white people better than the rest of the world. Brothers and sisters, this is a violation of the third commandment. This is taking the Lord's name in vain. This is imposing on God something God did not intend. Whenever you think you're speaking for God, be very careful. White supremacy is evil, wicked, and wrong. And I want you to hear that from this place. When anyone thinks they are better than anybody else because of faith or skin color or status, they are evil, wicked, and wrong. It is a violation of the third commandment. Now, the fourth commandment is one that we think we've figured out. Honor the Sabbath and keep it holy. Except a lot of us are going to go somewhere after worship and be busy buying stuff and doing stuff. And well, maybe that's okay. But the intent of this commandment, at some point in our life during the week, we ought to stop and consider, who am I really? Whose am I really? And what am I supposed to do with that important information? Remember the Sabbath. Honor the Sabbath. Keep it holy. Figure out, what is God calling me to do this week? What do I need to repair in terms of relationships that I've hurt, things that I have said? What do I need to do this week to be closer to God's hope and dream for my life? Honor your father and your mother. It's partly directed to children. All of us are children. It's also directed to parents. It's not just honoring a mother and a father, it is being honorable parents. It is remembering as parents we have been entrusted with the power and the responsibility of caring for the next generation. It is for those of us who don't have biological children to see the importance of our callings too. To be mentors and Sunday school teachers, to be kind and gentle and resonant with those who are around us. That we can assist when parents are exhausted and just trying to keep life together. And some of us can step in and be honorable surrogate parents and give assistance and love and faith development. I always thought I was doing pretty well on number six, don't murder. But the problem with Jesus' perspective on this, and he's very clear both about this and about adultery, you cannot do the physical act and still be in violation of the sixth and seventh commandment. You can disregard other human beings and have complete disrespect for who they are. You can just simply overlook folks who are around you. And Jesus says, when you do that, it's just like killing them. You are guilty of a violation of the sixth commandment. When you take advantage of another person, when you use somebody else as your own property and your own pleasure, you have just violated the seventh commandment, Jesus says. When you have lust in your heart and you look at someone else as a piece of property, you have violated number seven. Just because you've never stolen anything doesn't mean you haven't coveted And just because you don't spread rumors doesn't mean you haven't gossiped and violated number 9. This poor, successful guy in the 12th chapter of Luke, if only he had been a little more conversant on the Ten Commandments and a little more aware of his surroundings and the people that were willing and waiting to fill his life with community and love. But he completely overlooked all that. The commandments are interesting the way they're laid out. So let's quickly look at this before we conclude and remind ourselves the Ten Commandments are actually a group of 4 and then a group of 6. So on our next to last slide, we've got this breakup where there are 4 commandments devoted to our relationship with God, and there are 6 commandments related to our relationship with community and one another. And if you think about the shape of this direction, it is our vertical relationship with God, 1 through 4, and it's our horizontal relationships with community and one another, 5 through 6, that as far as shape goes, it's in the shape of what? A cross. In the shape of this gift that Jesus has offered us in connecting us with eternity and with each other. What emerges then out of this 12th chapter of Luke, the diagnosis that Jesus gives with this poor guy who was so successful, he completely lost perspective on who he was and whose he was. But Jesus also provides a remedy. The remedy is not so much in the story. The story is all about the diagnosis. The remedy is woven throughout the Gospel of Luke and all 4 Gospels. And it has to do with this. If only this guy in the 12th chapter had been more grateful. Part of our calling in life to escape the fate of this guy is to be grateful. There is a power in gratitude. So our first point, be grateful. The remedy, be grateful. There's power in gratitude. Being thankful is a mysterious sense of updwelling in us that allows us to be a part of something bigger than ourselves. However, it's possible this guy in the 12th chapter, in the midst of his success, he could have simply said, I am so grateful for the abundance of my crops, and missed out on the next calling that we have. It's one thing to be grateful, which is vital, but also we must be gracious. This guy, in his gratitude, could have and should have said, there were a whole host of people who helped to plant my crops, nurture the seeds, till the soil, weed the ground, take care of the crops, pick the produce, bring it into the house, set it all up, clean it. All these people, what a gift it is to be a part of this community. Instead, Jesus is clear in the diagnosis, he had forfeited his community because it was all about him. To be gracious is to recognize this isn't just about me, it's about us, and everything that I have in my life is a part of a broader fabric of people contributing to the richness of my life and your life. To be grateful also incorporates this sense of graciousness. I would not be here today if it weren't for this whole host of saints and people who loved me and nurtured me and cared for me. Even today, this group of saints that surrounds me and you, we would not be here in all that we are if it were not for this vital community of people in our lives that have contributed to who we are and constantly remind us whose we are. So we're called to be grateful, we're called to be gracious, And finally, we're called to be generous. Some of you were here in this sanctuary this past Monday night when Barbara Brown Taylor presented to us, and I had the great privilege of interacting with her. And prior to our time together, we talked on the phone beforehand to kind of talk about our interview, and then we're in the deacon's ready room talking about what was coming up and interacting. And as we were talking, people would walk by, and she would look down the hallway, and she would call this person by name, somebody she hadn't seen in 5 or 6 or 8 years. And she would say hello and then turn to me and say, "She gave me some insights as a student. He contributed to my ability to understand this more deeply." It was an incredible spirit of generosity, not only gracious in recognizing how much people have contributed to our lives, but speaking the truth and being generous and spreading love and thanksgiving and appreciation. And I said to her, throughout Holy Envy, her last book that we've been talking about and enjoying, and that was the presentation on Monday, I gave a whole series of adjectives that described the book, but I concluded with this one. It's a generous work. Because throughout Holy Envy, she specifically cites a whole host of people from all walks of life and all over the country, all over the world, who have contributed to her insights and wisdom and life. She is extraordinarily generous in her appreciation and sense of thanksgiving, of being able to share the fact that she is better and wiser today because of all the wisdom and contributions those friends and people across the world have offered to her. If only our gentleman in the 12th chapter of Luke had added to this perspective he had a sense of gratitude, of generosity, and this beautiful sense of graciousness. And the same today for you and for me. The calling Jesus gives to us, gently sometimes, a little perhaps more loudly other times. Brothers and sisters, may we leave from this place not stumbling into that same successful dilemma that this guy, this rich fool in chapter 12 did, but instead be very intentional. Obey the commandments. Fear God and live out gratitude, graciousness, and generosity. May it be so in the name of Jesus. Amen.